This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to continue our conversation about how the Biden campaign is engaging with Latino voters. This year, 32 million Latinos are eligible to vote, making up the largest non-white voting bloc in history. As we reported about 2 weeks ago, there have been a lot of stories since. The Biden campaign is not doing enough to reach out to Latinos, and so we're going to find out what has changed in the past couple of weeks. And then on Friday, we are going to focus on the New York Times investigation about Donald Trump's taxes. I also want to make sure that I gave out the right URL for election protection. Someone on Twitter just said, be sure to let people know it is protectthevote.net. Protectthevote.net. Net. It's not .com. It is .net. Thank you so much for that tweet. Now we are going to get an update on the ongoing wildfires in Northern California. The Glass Fire continues to rage in Napa and Sonoma counties. According to CAL FIRE, the cause of the fire still has not been determined. It has left the cities of Calistoga and Angwin nearly empty. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, nearly 70,000 residents have been evacuated. More than 42,000 acres have burned. According to CAL FIRE, it is only 2% contained, just 2%. On Sunday afternoon, just 200 miles north of that fire, another fire started. The Zog Fire destroyed 146 structures and has consumed more than 40,000 acres across Shasta County. Three people have tragically died from that fire. Joining us now is Don Hankins, a pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at Cal State University at Chico. Don is a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. Hi, Don. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
So how are you doing up there? You're up in Butte County, not too far from that fast-moving Zog Fire.
Well, yeah, we're actually close to the North Lightning Complex, safe enough distance away, but it's had us on pins and needles with the winds over the last weekend and early into this week. Fortunately, things have held in terms of the fire line, and I think the west side of the complex, they're saying, will be contained hopefully today. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. But a long season ahead for sure.
Yeah, this is so tough, Don. My dad said that five of his friends were evacuated. My aunt and uncle have been evacuated. Luckily, their homes are still standing. But people just keep saying, you know, how much can we take?
Right. Yeah, no, the season, unfortunately, you know, I've had to have the mindset that we're in it for the long haul. You know, with the lightning ignitions about a month ago, we've got a long season still ahead of us until we get significant rainfall. And while it is definitely, you know, something that tugs on our minds and abilities to cope with these things, we have to be mindful of the things that we can do and take preventative measures as we can and think ahead to what the future might be for, you know, fire stewardship in these particular areas that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, and that's what we talked about when you were on last time. The Chronicle has a really good piece this morning. It's an interactive map showing how the climate crisis has spiraled out of control. And they write, global warming fueled by human emission of greenhouse gases has dried out trees and shrubs, making a single spark much more likely to explode into a catastrophic fire. Decades of poor forest management and unwise development patterns have primed the state for disaster, and 40 million people are now living with the consequences. And this is something that we talked about last time, Don. You can't really point at any one thing. There are a number of factors here.
Yes, absolutely. There's a long history, obviously, of you know, trying to increase the number of trees that we have in our forest, for instance, and excluding fire as part of that. And obviously with the shifting climate, we have a lot of different factors that are at play. And then having as many people as we do, there's a lot more sources or opportunities for ignition to occur with the infrastructure like PG&E's power lines, for instance, in you know, many of our regions. And, you know, people doing land management on their own properties, you know, using equipment and so forth are all different sources of ignitions that are at play within our landscapes, and we definitely need to be thinking about how we can minimize that. And the climate change is definitely a big part of that too. You know, we have to be paying attention to our landscape and what the cues in the environments are to know when to safely use equipment and when we can safely use fire and all those different things.
You know, Don, after the election, we want to do a week-long series to really dive in and spend a lot of time looking at how we got here and what needs to change at the federal, state, and local levels. So given that it is just so bad, I mean, we have, what, 2 more months of fire season?
At least, right?
Right, at least. What are your thoughts when you think about the major changes that you would like to see?
Well, I think at a landscape scale, we really need to be thinking about that. We need to be thinking about how, you know, these fires are obviously big that we're seeing. We need to think strategically where within the landscape we can deal with addressing, you know, any ignitions and how to limit the spread of those through the bigger portion of the landscape. And that means that we're going to have to do a lot more treatment. And I tend to use fire as that tool to think about how to do that treatment. So, you know, as I think about the areas here in Butte County, you know, that means putting fire back into the footprint of the campfire and fire back into the footprint of the lightning complex, for instance, but also getting to those places where we haven't seen fire and looking at the glass fire and what it's burned through. You know, some of the areas that it burned through, some of the most significant portions of it have actually been in places that haven't had any fire at a reasonable scale, a map scale, in the last 120-some-odd years that's been recorded in the state. So, you know, these are places that we should put priority on, and there's reasons why sometimes these places aren't burning. Maybe it's because they're in a wind shadow or something to that effect, but, you know, we do need to be treating those areas too. So retreating the areas that are burned and then treating areas that haven't been burned, we need to prioritize that and think about that in a strategic manner to, you know, to have better stewardship and minimize the spread of fire down the road.
So what explains the areas that have not been burned historically that are now being burned?
Yeah, well, I haven't been able to really dive too much into it around the glass fire in particular, but I was looking at like wind patterns and things like that this morning in terms of seeing, you know, how does the north winds, you know, affect this area, or is it an easterly wind, or is it a place that's kind of void within the landscape? And I don't have a conclusion on that, but, you know, I can definitely point to different areas of the state where we can think about, you know, areas north of, say, the Feather River drainage in the area of the North Lightning Complex and the campfire. Those areas, there's certain areas that are kind of outside of the typical wind flows that come out of the Feather River drainage, and so those are places that are typically not going to see a lot more, you know, of like the wind-driven events affecting it. Plus, you know, we think about like how much moisture do some of these places get. I happen to live on a ridge that's one of the highest rainfall areas of the state, so we've got, you know, the factor of wind not being too much of a problem, and then a lot of rainfall that typically falls even during the drought, you know, periods that we've had. These are factors that kind of lead into it, so we have to understand that, you know, across the landscape and think about why are some of these places not burning and so forth. And it's not that they won't burn, and we all recognize that, you know, these landscapes will burn at some point, but we have to make the decision of what the conditions are going to burn under. Is it going to be, you know, nature's time frame or an arsonist time frame or infrastructure's mm-hmm. time frame or, you know, whatever it is. We mm-hmm. need to make that choice and steward it in a way to avoid, you know, devastation within the landscape.
Well, right. And to your point of arson, we talked about this last time you were on the show, that the majority of these fires are started by humans, whether it's intentional or accidental. And what's happening now is because of these various factors, like the Chronicle pointed out this morning, a single spark is much more likely now to explode into a catastrophic fire.
Yeah, and a lot of the, you know, think about some of the places that are burning, and you know, in particular, think about the Zog Fire. A lot of that area, at least on the edges of it, are within the area that burned in the Carr Fire. And so, we're in an area that's got a lot of fine fuels, like grasses, and those grasses, particularly when we have lower relative humidity, are going to be much more receptive to an ember landing on it or a spark landing on it and then starting a fire. And when you add wind, then you're adding a component that allows for that fire to really accelerate and spread very quickly through the landscape and really difficult to try to contain it. So when we have, you know, these fine fuels are the dominating factor, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of the ability not to be able to contain it very easily because of the rapid rate of spread that it happens.
Today we're speaking with Don Hankins, a pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at Chico State. He's a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. If you have any questions for Don about the fires and what needs to change, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Don, when it comes to land management, the federal government controls 48% of California's lands. California only controls 3% of its wild lands. Of course, we should say this is indigenous land, that was taken. What are your thoughts about that, and how does that factor in when it comes to controlled burns?
Right. Well, a lot of different layers there to dissect. Just to point out, and for listeners, you know, when you talk about the land being taken, you know, California has no treaty tribes. So in 1850, we have what are called the 18 unratified treaties within the state that basically the state didn't ratify treaties with the tribes to relinquish rights to land. So tribes still have rights to their ancestral territories, and that's something that you know we have to recognize. But then pointing to the current situation with land tenure, you know, with the forest, you know, a lot of the federal government lands, you know, within the state, I think there's policies that are there that allow for the stewardship to take place. We need to be facilitating the ability to allow for collaboration with indigenous leadership, I think, as being a big part of that, to bring fire back into the landscape. And this would help to also rectify, you know, the situation with the 18 ratified treaties that I referenced, where people are still able to steward within their landscapes and maintain those relationships. But working together, we're able to go farther with that than if we just, say, hand over the traditional knowledge and the stewardship of fire. That doesn't help out on the cultural side of being able to maintain a living, connected culture to the landscape, which is vital. So I really see, you know, the opportunity there for us all to be working together as California. It's not just the federal government's role to do that. It's not just the state's role to do that, but it's all of us working together. And I think that's really going to help us to get there. And you know, if you think about the private landowners, we have to have capacity for those private landowners to be able to engage with the ability to use fire within their landscape. So how do we get there? And you know, how can that cultural knowledge be applied in those places as well?
According to many estimates, at least half of the world's land is held by indigenous people. Some estimates are high as 65%. What is it? What is the percentage in California?
Well, I think what you're referring to maybe is looking at the amount of land base that's stewarded under indigenous cultures globally, which is, I forget, the Archipelago of Hope is a book that talks about that. And in California, I think, you know, the actual acreages that are stewarded, if we look at like federal reservation lands and so forth, we're you know, dealing with a pretty small portion of the state. If we look at the, you know, actual maps of it, the larger reservations that stand out would be like Hoopa and Yurok reservations up in on the Klamath and Trinity River, Covelo Round Valley Reservation out in Mendocino County area, and then Tule River Reservation down in the Southern Sierras. But otherwise, a lot of the tribal lands are really small. We have a lot of rancherias that are within the state that are, you know, the smallest is probably like an acre. So it's a pretty small land holding on the federal government side. But when you get back to the idea of you know, those land bases and not having treaties within the state, the Aboriginal territory, the traditional territories that people have occupied and still maintain connection to, those are pretty big areas. And, you know, they can cover vast, you know, ranges from you know, the tops of the Sierras all the way out to the ocean, for instance, for some certain tribes. You know, but being able to engage the landscape scale within that, there's not the ability to do that at this point in time.
Yeah, and sadly, a couple of weeks ago, the Karuk tribe put out a press release saying that about 150 homes had been damaged or destroyed in the small community of Happy Camp. Many of these homes belong to Karuk tribal members and their families.
Right. And so, yeah, they've declared a state of emergency up there and have requested the federal government and the state to, you know, be included within the emergency relief packages that are coming forward. You know, and Karuk is a pretty large tribe. There's a lot of tribal members, but their land base is really fragmented. And so they've got a lot of federal lands that are there through the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, but not really the ability to outright steward in those places. They're getting closer. In fact, I'd say that as a tribe, they're probably a little bit more in alignment with being able to do the types of things that need to be taking place because of the relationships that they've built with the Forest Service and BLM. But, you know, it's not to the point where tribal families can go out and just set fires within the landscape and do things as traditionally had been done, you know, even into the 1930s in some of these places. So,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just when you think about what has changed over the past couple of decades in terms of development. I was talking to my dad, who used to be a sheet metal worker, and he said, I remember working on these homes in these wild places. I always remember thinking, should they be building these subdivisions in these forests?
Right. And that's always it's an important question that comes up. You know, a lot of people ask, you know, well, should people live in some of these places? And I guess, you know, one thing that I always tend to look at, and in particular, I think about like paradise, you know, and, mm-hmm. and where it's located, is that people have always lived there, and people have always lived on the ridge where I live. You know, those are the indigenous settlements. I guess there are places, obviously, that people wouldn't have traditionally lived in the densities they're in, and that's where we have to think a little bit about how do we build differently? How do we build homes that are more fire resistant? And I have this vision, I guess I kind of joke, you know, I know a lot of people that have lost homes in particularly the campfire. You know, I think there's probably like at least 70 people that I know who lost their homes in the campfire. But as I think about rebuilding in these kind of environments and how to build better in these environments, you know, what are the different ways that we could build? And one of the visions that I have in my head is like, imagine the Sydney Opera House, you know, made out of tile and, you know, like the space shuttle where it's, you know, fire-resistant tiles and those kinds of things. And if we can be more innovative about the way that we build, then, you know, we have the ability for our houses to be more resistant to fire. Because currently the way we build mostly is stick construction. So we're basically taking, you know, wood from the forest that was a living tree and having it as dry fuel within the built environment. And at some point, it's, you know, it's just like a standing dead forest. It will burn. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing happening. But we have the ability to change the way that we build in these places and make it more sustainable for all of us.
And final quick thoughts, Don. Governor Gavin Newsom recently announced plans to ban all sales of new gasoline-powered cars by 2035. He set the goal of 100% zero-emission energy sources for the state's electricity by 2045. You know, a lot of environmental groups are saying we need something today. You know, they're calling on him to deal with fracking, to deal with fossil fuels today, not in 2035 or 2045. What are your thoughts?
Wow. Well, that's a pretty big one. I haven't had a full opportunity to digest that recommendation that he's put out there. But I do think we definitely do need to change. And, you know, I think we need to be thinking about how our policies work. You know, I guess one of my thoughts is that, you know, when we come up with these green solutions or what we think are green solutions, there's still an impact somewhere. And so as a society, we really need to think about that. For instance, we think about electric vehicles and where is the battery, you know, the sources for building those batteries coming from. And so I think the more innovative types of materials that we can use, the more truly renewable types of things like maybe hydrogen gas or things like that may be better options for us. But we need to keep pushing the technology to build, you know, our vehicles in a better way. You know, I guess I've always envisioned maybe going back on a horse if we needed to. You know, but we definitely have to think about our own personal choices and lifestyles in the way that we can contribute to that, because it's not something that the government itself is going to be able to achieve on its own.
And there's also, of course, price.
Right.
Right. How are people going to afford these new technologies?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
Well, Don, thank you again for joining us. And,
thanks,
you know, when we do this in-depth week-long series, we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Don Hankins is a pyrogeographer and professor of geography and planning at Chico State in California. He is a Plains Miwok fire expert who studies indigenous traditional knowledge. And we definitely are going to do a couple of series about fires, how we got here, what changes are needed. And if you have any show ideas for us or guest ideas, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our coverage looking at how the Biden campaign is engaging with Latino voters ahead of the election. 32 million Latinos are eligible to vote, making up the largest non-white voting bloc in history. Both campaigns are spending millions of dollars to reach Spanish-speaking voters in battleground states. So far, Biden has spent more So how are Latino communities responding? That is tomorrow. You can find more information about Your Call and listen to past shows at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.